The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's Halaf. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. New Year's greetings, my dear listeners. Hopefully, you are on your way to successfully maintaining at least one of your New Year's resolutions. And if you are struggling to maintain good decisions and lessen bad habits, don't worry. Lots of us are right there with you. In fact, the stories we'll hear today will help us remember that it can be really hard to maintain progress toward our goals, even if those goals weren't entirely intentional. Today, we debut a new to That's a Laugh author for your listening pleasure. Let's give a towel welcome to Lori Notaro and her book, Enter Pirates, Vintage Legends, 1991 through 1999, copyright 2016. First, the book's introduction. A note. "Hey," my sister Lisa said when I answered the phone. "I'm cleaning out Nana's house, and guess what I found? If it's been trapped in that house for the 8 years it's been empty, and it looks like a leather purse with teeth, I don't want to know," I replied. "I'll give you a hint," she continued. "It's yellow with age, torn in spots, and has your name on it." "I know," I answered, ashamed. "Apparently, when I stay at Mom's, I leave my underwear all over her house, too. They keep sending it back to me. Dad picks them up with his barbecue tongs." "I was going to tell you to guess again," my sister said, "but you just grossed me out so bad on the last one that I'm going to stop here. Your columns. I found your columns from the State Press." "You're kidding," I laughed. "Which ones?" "All of them," my sister told me. "It looks like every single one. Some of them date back to 1991. There is a very good possibility that you were not born yet, but I was, and working at the State Press, a student-run newspaper at Arizona State University. By default, and someone else's drunk driving jail sentence, I ended up writing the humor column mainly because I gave myself the job. I was the editor of the Arts and Entertainment magazine. My humor columnist was trying to make bail, and someone had to fill the spot. It was an assignment of necessity, and I used to feel embarrassed by it until a world full of bloggers came onto the scene and not only gave themselves their own column, but their own website to boot. At least I was working toward my degree in journalism and had column inches to fill. Yes, journalism. Now that word doesn't mean very much, but in 1991, there were several newspapers in every city, and you could actually make a living at working at one. Way before the internet killed that dream, giving birth to not only bloggers, but news that doesn't require sources. Anyway, I wrote the column week after week, always hoping to find someone else to do it, but I never did. And 25 years later, I'm still writing it, although newspapers barely exist. I wrote on a Macintosh Classic and barely saved anything on a floppy disk. So unless I had a copy of the magazine itself, most of that stuff was lost to the ages. I never even thought about seeing it again or trying to find copies. I had moved 4 times since then, and whatever made it to my basement in Oregon was undoubtedly dissolved in one of our many sewer overflows. And then came my sister's phone call. She found a Giorgio Armani bag stuffed full of newspaper stories, my columns that Nana and Pop-Pop had clipped out week after week and saved. I couldn't believe it. I thought that stuff was gone forever. My mother mailed it up to Oregon along with Nana's old mink, and honestly, I just let it sit there for a couple of months. While I was curious about seeing my work 25 years later, I was terrified that it would really suck, And some of them did. There were a couple that were terrible, but others weren't half bad. And then several of them actually made me laugh. Although I will admit that I winced at reading some of my own escapades, it was like I had opened my own time capsule and found myself much younger, thinner, and dumber inside. There was my world before I had written Idiot Girls, before I was married, had nieces and nephews, was still in college, and not stopping long enough to even sow my wild oats. I was just dropping them as I went along. My sister said I should collect them and publish them, sort of a prequel to Idiot Girls, and offered to help type them up. My husband also offered to lend his 10 fingers. So together, we recreated what I wrote beginning in 1991 and formed a collection I'm calling Enter Pirates. It's not heavy reading. It's goofy and silly and slightly reckless. But it made me laugh, and my biggest hope is that you have the very same reaction. Awesomely, Lori, March 21st, 2016. Our first story from Lori's articles reminds us that stopping bad habits is done incrementally. Often, circumstances can help us take advantage of opportunities to make better decisions, or at least help us get that difficult, seemingly painful, first step of our journey out of the way. The article title, Too Late. It was a Friday when my pop-pop called me and I heard the news. As I returned the phone to its cradle, I immediately reached for my car keys in a desperate and selfish effort to save myself. It was the survival instinct kicking in, taking charge, telling me that I had to get to the nearest store and get there quickly. There was no time to waste. Marlboro's, it had just been reported, had been poisoned and were being recalled. I had to get there before all of the Marlboros were taken off the shelves, poisoned or not. My heart was pounding. My flesh was sweating. Where were my keys? I ransacked my bed for the sound of them, scoured the bathroom, and was about to dive into the kitchen when I heard the panicked, stampeding feet of horses. I looked up and saw, through my bedroom window, the four riders of the apocalypse galloping down my street, headed for the corner Circle K. It was then that I knew it was true. The unspeakable had happened. I was too late. Oh, God, I was too late! I heard the whine of the sirens in the distance. The sky turned black with boiling red clouds. The only thing I could do was find every last cigarette, butt, and flake of tobacco and hoard them. To say that I wasn't very lucky would be putting it quite mildly. As it happened, I had gotten paid that day, but didn't have enough time to go to Costco to get my standard 2 cartons. Instead, I had the remnants of the last 2 cartons from the payday 2 weeks before, which screeched in with a grand total of 7 whole cigarettes, 3 half-smoked cigarettes, and 5 butts, with at least 3 drags left on each. I packed them all in a double-bagged Ziploc baggie and submerged them in the water tank behind the toilet. Drastic measures, you say? Perhaps silly, extreme, desperate? Well, all I knew is that of the tens of thousands of people that I know who smoke, 50% of those smoke Marlboros, and I knew that once they were down to their lucky cigarette, it would be my door they'd be breaking through with a pickaxe trying to get their fix. Addicts are not very pretty people, and I, as an addict, was going to protect my stash. I got a pen and paper and figured out a ration schedule to see how long my smokes would hold out until the relief packages of Marlboros arrived. I wasn't going to last more than 2 hours. I felt my heart drop. so I decided that I would only be able to smoke under the most necessary and dire of conditions, which was doing my morning business. And, as I know, it takes 3 cigarettes to complete the entire transaction until the final flush, so I was safe for 3 days. But I figured if I ate an abundance of raw vegetables, especially broccoli, I might be able to last longer. If this sounds odd to any of you non-smokers, let me recall the story of my friend Doug, who had trouble one day. Let's just say doing his duty on the throne. He mentioned this enigma to another friend of his, who promptly and respectfully solved the problem by sticking a cigarette in Doug's mouth, lit it, and then sent him back to the potty, adding quietly, "You know not what you do." From that day forward, no one I know ever saw Doug go into a bathroom, public or private, without a smoke in one hand and a dirty magazine in the other. It was a done deal. The obvious solution to the great Marlboro embargo of 1995 would be, quite naturally, to switch brands until the cyanide or insecticide was removed from the filters of the contaminated cigarettes. But this I could not bring myself to do. Last year, during my birthday season, only one birthday card sailed through the post office and to my house. I didn't recognize the return address. It was from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I pondered. I studied the envelope. Then I opened it. On the front of the card was a valley drenched with autumn, a small farmhouse, a trail of wild horses, and the snow on top of blue-peaked mountains. Inside, the card read in big crimson letters, "In a land this big, you can't dream small. Happy birthday from Marlboro Country." Tucked in the seam of the card was a present for me, 100 bonus country store miles to go toward the Marlboro casket or oxygen tent of my choice. I was stunned. I was moved. I was crying. I made a commitment, you see, when I was 14 and took my first drag off of a Marlboro Red while hiding in a desert lot across the street from my high school. My head whipped off my shoulders, spinning in the sky, until I had planted my denim sassooned butt in the dirt, but I knew I had found something I couldn't live without. 15 years later, the desert lot is gone, built up into condos, which I accidentally set a little on fire during the construction stage the following year, but the commitment is still there. It has to be there. Black stuff starts bubbling like Texas tea out of my chest when I try to take the commitment away. I know for a fact that my lungs contain enough tar to pave every cross-country highway in the continental United States. My boyfriend came home later that night and asked me if I had heard the news, and I nodded. "Were you able to buy any cigarettes today?" he asked. "No," I said as I shook my head sadly. "Me either," he added, "and I don't have any left." Oh, no. Oh, boy. Oh, crap. 7 cigarettes divided by 2 equaled not enough for me to share. "Me too," I sinned. "It's going to be a rough couple of days," he sighed. I agreed. Life during wartime. So I made dinner. We rented a movie in which the characters chain-smoked. I hate that. 3 hours had passed since I had had my last puff. I started to shake a little, and then I got dizzy. I began to cough. I had to do something. "I'll be right back," I said, getting up. "I have to go to the bathroom." He didn't suspect a thing. I ran to the bathroom, pulled the lid off the tank, and the bag out of the water. I carefully chose one of the half-smoked ones, since this situation didn't classify as a biological emergency. I took the first hit. Instantly, my hands became steady. My lungs stopped percolating. My head cleared. I was alive again. Each subsequent drag tasted as good as the first, and I sucked on that thing until the filter began to glow. I walked back into the living room and sat down next to my boyfriend, who was fully engrossed in the movie, watching people smoke and smoke and smoke. "Isn't it funny," he said after a couple of minutes, "that I want a cigarette so bad after watching these people smoke that actually I smell it?" "It's amazing what the mind can do," I agreed. "You don't smell that?" he asked. "Nope," I said, shaking my head. He looked at me. "Do that again," he requested. "Do what?" I questioned. "Shake your head." "Why?" I said, my face getting pretty hot. "That smell is coming from you. It's coming from your head," he said suspiciously. "Shake your head, honey." "No." "Shake your head, honey." "No! You have smoke hair. It's on you. I can smell it," he cried. "Where are they? The bathroom?" "Of course they're in the bathroom." "It's just my regular smell," I protested. "It's my scent." "You're hoarding, you foul temptress, addict. You have to share. It's in the rules." "I made a commitment," I yelled. "They sent me a birthday card." "And I bought you a carton for your birthday," he replied. I broke down. He was right. It's in the rules, despite survival of the fittest or most addicted. "But what about my morning business?" I whimpered as he led me down the hall towards the bathroom. "We'll just eat lots of broccoli and Mexican food," he said, but not after I lifted up the lid of the water tank and handed him the dripping bag. If at first you don't succeed, try again, especially when trying to stop bad habits. The next article, Nobody Likes a Quitter. The cigarette pack weighed as much as if there was nothing in it. I shook it. All I heard were the tumble of tobacco flakes being tossed from one side of the pack to the other. I could have sworn I had one left. I gave up on shaking it and ripped it open instead. I was sure I had one left. I wouldn't have smoked that last one in such a hurry if I knew it was going to be my last. Looking down at the shredded paper and cellophane in my hands, I realized that I should have enjoyed my last cigarette a little bit more. I was out, completely 100% out of cigarettes, and I was right smack in the middle of nicotine fit. It was 115 degrees outside. My car was in the shop with a seriously busted axle. The closest store was a half mile away. I threw my head into my hands and cursed myself for not buying a house next door to a Circle K. Either way, through nicotine withdrawal or a perilous pedestrian journey through the desert, I was going to be taking a death trip very, very soon. I was afraid. All of a sudden, I thought of something incredibly stupid. It was so stupid, I even laughed out loud at it. I should quit. Now is the perfect time to quit. I'm out of cigarettes, which is amazing, because I usually buy two cartons at a time. I need to use an inhaler to breathe if I want to go to sleep. My throat always hurts. I smell. My fingers are yellow. My breath is bad. I can't laugh without coughing up what looks like an embryo. And somehow that argument worked. It made sense. I honestly don't know what happened to me, but I decided that I was going to quit. It was 2:13 p.m. on Tuesday, August 1st. I remember hearing somewhere that the urge to smoke a cigarette will pass in 10 minutes, whether you have one or not. At 2:24 p.m. on Tuesday, August 1st, I knew it was the biggest, cruelest lie anyone had ever told. By the time my husband came home, I had only a pinky's grasp left on my sanity. I had locked the cat, the dog, and myself in separate bedrooms so they wouldn't agitate me into killing them, and I hid under the covers in my bed. I decided I wasn't going to tell him about my lifestyle change until he noticed, just to see how attentive he was. When I heard the front door shut, I rocketed myself out of bed and decided to fix dinner. "Hi, honey," I said as I met him coming down the hall. "What would you like for dinner?" "Oh, anything is fine," he answered. This made me mad. It made me furious. "Why can't you," I said, immediately throwing my hands on my hips, "just this once, make a decision, huh? Why is it always my job, Mr. Anything's Fine? Grow a backbone, for Christ's sake. Why is this whole house my responsibility?" "Okay," my husband said as he took a deep breath. "How about chicken?" So I made some hamburger helper, calmed myself down a bit, put dinner on the table. We turned on the TV, sat down, and he reached for my plate, scooped a bunch of green beans, hamburger helper, and potatoes onto it, then set it back down in front of me. "What did you do that for?" I asked. "I just did it to be nice," he replied. "I can get my own food," I yelled. "I don't like when it touches." "Did your mom come over today?" he said, putting his hand on my shoulder. "Ah!" I shouted. "Don't touch me! Don't touch me when I'm eating!" "What the hell is wrong with you?" he pleaded. "I quit smoking today," I cried. "I haven't had a cigarette in almost 4 hours. Right now, I would stick my tongue up your nose if I could smoke afterwards." But I couldn't smoke. I had made the decision not to. When the desire to light up hit me, which it did every 2 minutes, I just told myself over and over again that smoking wasn't an option. I began smoking pens, pencils, straws, old butts, and rolled up pieces of paper. I ate sunflower seeds, which didn't help, and swallowed bottles of Golden Seal, which made me very regular. It occurred to me when I had survived day two, after I had verbally assaulted a clerk at a bookstore, written a nasty, obscene letter to the editor, and hadn't slept in 30 hours, that smoking affected a larger chunk of my life than I had originally thought, like the whole thing. Smoking was a bigger hobby than I had previously thought, which made sense. It was my only hobby. The urge to smoke, the desire, the craving, the need, it wasn't any such thing. It was so far beyond that. It had become an emotion. In fact, my thought process no longer even had a word for smoking. When my body wanted to do it, it just sent out a quick firing synapses thing that overwhelmed and smothered my whole person with the command and the feeling that I was about to burst out uncontrollably into tears. It didn't tell me to smoke. Instead, it said, "Do that thing." Every time the phone rings and it's for me, "Do that thing." When take the last bite of any meal, "Do that thing." If I get a new magazine or a book and I want to read it on the potty, "Do that thing." When it's normally time for my morning business, "Do that thing." When I wake up, "Do that thing." When I sit down in front of a keyboard, "Do that thing now." Nothing was fun anymore. Well, nothing except for one thing, and even that came to a screeching halt. We were at Costco the following Saturday, shopping for pickles, pretzels, car window shades, and 409. I suddenly realized how late in the afternoon it was, and rushed him over to the snack part of Price Club, where they give out samples, since the free food party is generally over after lunchtime. I was having a lucky day, gathering up 2 samples of each of peach pie, stuffed pork roast, ravioli in pesto sauce, and morning fruit bars, one for me and one for mi esposo. Luckily, he wasn't hungry, so I got to have 2 of everything, and I was happy as a shithouse rat, especially when I captured the chocolate chip cookie samples. I was about to load a cookie chaser into my mouth when he grabbed my arm and herded me over into a quiet, unoccupied corner. "Lori, I didn't want to mention this here," he began with a very serious look on his face. "But you haven't stopped chewing since Tuesday. In 2 weeks, you're going to ask me how you got so fat, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to tell you. So, to avoid all of that, I'm asking you now to spit out that cookie." "But it's a chocolate cookie," I mumbled with my mouth full. "It's a good chocolate cookie. It's moist and chewy." He held out his hand. I spit back into the paper cup. "You don't understand," I complained. "Nothing can make me happy unless I inhale it." "But you're a non-smoker now," he informed me. "You're going to have to find something to replace cigarettes." "Then give me back that damn replacement cookie," I insisted. "And you are wrong, dead wrong. I am not a non-smoker. I am still a smoker, but one that isn't allowed to smoke." "I'm telling you that you need a hobby," he reiterated. "Macrame, porcelain plate collecting, yoga. What about kickboxing?" "I'm going to quit," I decided. "You already did," he replied. "I'm quitting smoking," I clarified. "Okay, then take a deep breath," he instructed. I did. "What did you hear?" he asked. I shook my head. "Exactly. If you had smoked regularly today, your lungs would have screamed like a rape whistle," my husband mentioned. He was right. I went back to quitting in the singular and discovered a new hobby, withdrawal. After all, I figured nobody likes a quitter, especially a two-faced one. We've run out of time for today's episode of That's Halaf. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's Halaf is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Are you enjoying the show? Do you have any humorous quotes or authors you'd like to share? We'd love to hear from you. If you have any comments or questions about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number one more time is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.